I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Susan Borat joins me now, the freelance writer, formerly a reporter with the Globe and Mail, has just written a new book, Carnivore Chic, From Pasture to Plate, A Search for the Perfect Meat. It is a delightful and fascinating read, sometimes gross, but always engrossing. The author provides a bit of history as to North Americans' eating habits, as well as a view on how meat is processed, evocatively told through her own journey, where she dabbled with vegetarianism. I don't know why I have trouble with that.
Maybe because you're a carnivore.
I probably am, yeah. After a scant 5 weeks and 37 hours, she was back to eating meat, but this time with a view to seeking ethical meat, taking us from five-star kitchens to an Inuit whale hunt and more. The book is published by Viking and retails for $35. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Susan Borat. Good morning, Ms. Borat.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start at the very beginning. You dedicate the book to your mother, thanking her for all those Sunday dinners. That's not a tradition at my house. is it still one with you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, at my parents' house, in the house I grew up in, yeah, it's all food all the time. We all just talk about food just continuously. And my mom's a great cook, and I think in some ways, you know, I didn't really appreciate it fully till I moved away from home. And as I've gotten a little bit older and, you know, gotten into cooking myself, I'm constantly phoning my mom, asking her for recipes and asking her how to cook meat.
Is that a tradition that's still prevalent among society today, that people still gather for that big meal once a week?
I think it depends. You know, I think once a week is probably a safe bet. Sundays, certainly in my home, you know, we all gather around on Sundays for dinner. But, you know, in this time-pressed era, I guess people don't have as much time as they used to. But I think there is a big, sort of trend to trying to change that.
In page 27 of the book, there's a sentence here, and I'll read it, and then we'll discuss it. It says, meat is the ultimate symbol of North American affluence. To consume a steak is, in a sense, to fulfill the promise of democracy and prosperity in middle-class America. A steak dinner seems a little more special or substantial than, say, if we went for a fish supper or we had chicken last night. Well, what do you think that says about us?
Well, I think there's a long history. I mean, certainly the mythology of the cowboy in North America, and certainly in places like Texas and Wyoming, and certainly Alberta. And you know, there are some who argue that the reason that North America was settled was that peasants in Europe wanted to eat more meat, and that's why they came to North America. They just weren't getting enough meat on their dinner plate. And so from the start of modern era in North America, there's been a huge celebration around beef. And it is still probably one of our most coveted foods.
Is the meat that we're eating now, as opposed to, let's say, that 30, 40 years ago, is it safer? Is it cleaner? Any of that sense do you get?
No. No, I really don't think it is.
With all the stuff that's like organic and grain-fed or whatever that we see in supermarkets and so on?
Well, and I think if you put it like that, yes. I don't know if it's safer. I think that it's as safe. But I think one of the real issues for a lot of us is we're worried about the meat that we eat. We're worried about things like salmonella and E. coli and mad cow disease. And certainly in industrial production, it has been a problem. We've just seen the biggest beef recall ever in the United States. That happened in Southern California just a couple of weeks ago. So, I mean, I think that with line speeds in the slaughterhouses being sped up, we do know that more pathogens are getting in our meat. Now, does that mean that there aren't, there isn't oversight? Sure there is, but I personally feel a lot more comfortable knowing where my meat comes from and knowing that it's been raised organically.
The book begins with a chapter, your experience at Maple Leaf Foods.
That's right.
How did you end up there?
Well, you know, and this is I hadn't ever really set out to write a food book. It just sort of happened, if you'll forgive me, organically. I went to a couple of years ago. I went to work undercover at Maple Leaf Foods. I went to get a job working on the assembly line. It was a story that I wrote for Report on Business magazine. And the reason that I went there originally was they were advertising for workers, and they just couldn't get anyone to do this job. And I really wondered, you know, how bad can it possibly be, and why do they have to bring in people from places like Mexico and China to do this work? And, I got a job slicing the cheeks out of hogs' heads, and it was pretty gruesome work. I don't know how detailed you want me to get here, but pig's blood seeping into my bra and picking up a hog's head. They're pretty heavy, and by a warm, sticky esophagus is not fun work. And it's also, it's incredibly dangerous, an incredibly dangerous job. It's one of the most dangerous jobs in North America. And so the upshot was that I walked off the factory floor bowing I was never going to eat meat again. And, my vegetarian conversion didn't last that long. And it really got me thinking very deeply about what it is that we're consuming when we eat meat. What are the social rituals, and why is it such an important part of our culture? And that's what really set me on this journey to find the perfect meat, to sort of, see the people who put meat on our dinner plates, to see them in action. And in fact, carnivore chic is not really a polemic or a manifesto, although I come out with some fairly good ideas as to how I would like to eat meat. But it's really an adventure, and it's the stories of, the whalers and the hunters and the cowboys and why they do what they do.
Susan, what are we consuming? What did you find working at Maple Leaf that sort of disturbed you?
Okay, well, I couldn't countenance eating meat in when so many people are exploited along the way just to get cheap meat on our dinner plates. The people at Maple Leaf Foods make about the same amount of money that the people working down the street at McDonald's do, at least for a starting job. I can't say specifically that there's anything wrong with Maple Leaf meat. I'm not saying it's unsafe. What I'm saying is that I didn't feel comfortable participating, even as a consumer, in, the so-called industrial meat complex. I wanted to have a much better idea of where my meat came from. I wanted to know that it was raised without antibiotics, that it was raised without, growth hormones, and that it was free of pathogens. And so I now seek out meat, not every single time, but as much as I can from a butcher that I know.
Yeah, when you worked at Maple Leaf, you worked on the kill floor.
Mm-hmm.
You said you were carving out cheeks from pigs' heads. Were the pigs slaughtered there?
The pigs were slaughtered at Maple Leaf. I mean, I didn't actually kill them, but they it was rather ironic that you'd be sitting in the lunchroom at Maple Leaf and you could hear the pigs being herded into their slaughter. It was a terrible, terrible sound, just as people were kind of tucking into their pork chops with mashed potatoes at lunch. I couldn't really get past that sort of disconnect, and I guess once people have been working there for a while, they kind of get used to the notion that, yes, that's what I'm going to eat, and it's being killed right outside the lunchroom.
Had you heard from Maple Leaf because of the story in Rob or for this book?
We didn't, quite frankly, Maple Leaf, I think it would be fair to say tried to have the story killed before I came out, and that didn't happen. I'm sure, I haven't heard from them, as far as the book goes. I'm sure that they probably aren't pleased that I'd be telling this story again. But in fairness to Maple Leaf, there's nothing that Maple Leaf is doing that other big meat processors, meat processors aren't doing. And it's all the same formula. So Maple Leaf isn't guilty of anything that other meat processors aren't guilty of, just to be clear on that.
I'm sure if I spent the same time you spent at Maple Leaf or any slaughterhouse or butcher, even a butcher shop for that matter, I would feel sort of grossed out. I sort of like my meat not knowing where it came from. You had the task of finding out what happened to it after it, you know, before it got to you. You became a vegetarian as a result of working there, but as you write in the book, that lasted 5 weeks and 37 hours. How did you go back? What brought you back?
Ironically, after working in a slaughterhouse that processes hogs, it was that glorious aroma of bacon. And, you know, according to a very informal and unscientific survey, it's bacon that always gets the vegetarians and lures them back. It's really pig candy.
And when you became a vegetarian, because your partner is a vegetarian.
That's right. And so, believe me, I even though I'm writing a meat book, I have nothing against vegetarians. I do live with it sounds like a quite impossible scenario, but I live with a vegetarian sports writer, and he's been vegetarian for 30 years. So, I mean, I eat a lot of vegetarian meals, and I, as I said, I've got nothing against vegetarians.
How does that work at home? I mean, if you want a steak, do you have a steak while he's eating tofu or whatever?
Well, he travels a lot, thankfully, for his job. So as soon as he's out of the house, I've got the roast in the oven or the steak on the barbecue. And so I don't really cook meat at home. But he certainly doesn't. You know, he doesn't mind if I eat meat at all. I tend to eat it out more often than cook it, unless he's not at home.
The idea of eating ethically has come up over the last couple of years. It's almost become fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
Is it important where you buy your meat?
Well, you know, I know that if you're a single mother, you know, in a household of, you know, three or four or five people, it's not always affordable to always buy organic meat. But I do think that what we're seeing now in our culture is a huge shift to eating ethically. And I think that's, you know, where vegetarians once held the moral high ground. It's kind of the meat eaters, the carnivores, have kind of wrested control of this debate. And they can now combine, you know, ethics with eating in the same sentence. And I think, as I said, you know, I do have my own prescription for how I eat ethically. And I think if we keep in mind things like, you know, that the animal should be treated humanely, we keep in mind things like our environmental footprint, because global meat production is estimated to double by the year 2050. And there's a lot of greenhouse gas that goes up there because of meat production. And so I think we really do have to think about how much meat we're eating. We don't need to eat as much meat as we do eat. We eat the equivalent of a medium-sized steak a day, and it's about twice what we need. So I really believe that you can be, you know, an ethical carnivore, a compassionate carnivore, if you eat less meat and eat better meat.
Do you find, you mentioned earlier that this recent beef recall that happened several weeks ago. Do you find that despite things like that, despite the little scares that we get from time to time, that beef eating decreases?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know what the figures are on beef eating. I know that over time, I do believe that it's decreased. I think, you know, we know that we shouldn't eat too much. I mean, because there is a lot of fat. It clogs our arteries. And so I think people have gone to leaner meats just over time. But it doesn't mean that, you know, once a week you shouldn't enjoy that, you know, amazing prime rib dinner or that, you know, ribeye.
What is an emasculator?
Oh.
You discussed that in the chapter. You went to the ranch, to a ranch in, where was the ranch again?
The ranch was in Beeville, Texas, which is really it's an amazing place. It's the cradle of the cattle industry. That was very close to where these great cattle drives, where they drove the cattle up to the rail lines. That's really where it all started. It's very close to San Antonio. It's sort of between San Antonio and Corpus Christi. And I hung out with some real cowboys, and they were dressed in Wranglers, and they had the red kerchiefs around their neck, and with the spurs and the whole bit. And this wasn't just it's not a theme park; it was a real place. And yes, I was there during I forget what they call the season actually, but they basically turn the calves, they castrate them, and that is what the emasculator is for.
You went to Alaska and you viewed a whale hunt. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about I guess comparing eating habits in the north as opposed to ours here in the south, if you will?
Well, I think in some ways the whale hunt was one of the more profound experiences I had. It really helped me see some connections between, how the Inupiat, that's what they call the native people in Alaska, what the Inupiat do and really what we're doing in our culture. And it really is a celebration around the kill. I mean, when they pull that whale up on the ice floe and butcher it, and the whole town comes out, and it's just this incredible blood splattered sight. They're really celebrating life in a way. It's a very spiritual experience, and honestly, I don't think it's really all that different than what we're doing, this weekend when we gather around the table for Easter dinner, whether it's over a turkey or a ham or, whether we go to the steakhouse. It really is, I think, in some ways, a celebration of life.
Did you taste whale meat?
We didn't actually catch a whale when I was there. They caught several after I left. Yes, I had some of last year's catch, and I had one of their most coveted foods, muktuk, which is essentially it's whale blubber, and I can't say that I would want that every night for dinner. I mean, it's not the taste that's so objectionable. It's really it's ugly. It looks like it's gray. It looks like a dirty undershirt, and just impossible to chew through. It really seemed like it was reinforced with a steel shank.
You went to Aspen, Colorado, and you looked at this primal diet, and I couldn't pronounce the word vegetarianism earlier, so I'm not going to try to pronounce his name. Vonderplanets, is that the guy's name?
Yes. Well, I'd heard about this in Toronto from my butcher. He had a couple of people that would come in regularly, and essentially the primal diet, they were practicing the primal diet, and essentially the primal diet consists of about 90% raw meat. So that includes not just your carpaccio, but raw chicken, raw everything. And yes, that was quite an experience. I ended up going to a raw meat potluck, as you said, in Aspen, Colorado, and I was in this incredible mansion and just surrounded by hippie dippy snowboarders and a sweat lodge entrepreneur and all kinds of high tech moguls. It was a very sort of wealthy crowd, and they had come out to see the guru of the movement. And yes, this guy's name, he's had several incarnations over his lifetime and several different names, but right now he's going by the name Ajanus Vonderplanets. And he's essentially a former two-bit actor from General Hospital who now has this cult following of about 20,000 people in North America. And the reason, the theory behind the primal diet is that things like E. coli and salmonella and all of these things, they actually cure disease. This is what he actually believes, and this is what the devotees of the diet believe. So it's, you know, E. coli is actually good for you. Salmonella is actually good for you. And I was a little astonished when I got back to Toronto, and I started doing some research and found that, in fact, some cancer researchers are actually, they're actually experimenting with a modified form of salmonella and a modified form of polio. And they're finding that in some cases, you know, people's cancer is actually going into remission.
You must have had fun. I'm just listening to you tell all these stories of all your travels and so on. You must have had fun researching this book.
You know, I never knew there was this much to know about meat, but it was just the adventure of a lifetime, and it was really just the people that I met, people that are just so incredibly passionate about what they do, from the whalers, you know, to the hunters and the cowboys.
What are your plans for Easter dinner?
Well, I plan to be at my folks' place, and I'm hoping they're going to have the prime rib dinner. You know, my mom, she does the old British thing with the Yorkshire puddings, and it's just delicious. I can't wait.
And that's your favorite cut of meat, prime rib, is it?
It's you know what, I think my favorite kind of meat is whatever kind of meat is in front of me, to tell you the truth. I mean, I couldn't believe how delicious moose is. Moose is just unbelievably good. I love charcuterie. I knew that if I was coming to Vancouver, I was going to have to go to a place on Blood Alley called Salt, and I had some amazing charcuterie there yesterday. And I love a good steak and, you know, a roast chicken. The list goes on and on and on.
That last chapter, I guess it's, what is it, the epilogue it's called, you describe, I guess that was last year's Easter dinner for you, was it?
Or? That's right.
And so, I mean, it's just wonderfully written, and compliments on that. Susan, I've enjoyed talking to you today, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you so much.
The book is called Carnivore Chic, From Pasture to Plate, A Search for the Perfect Meat, $35 from Viking. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Flatow.